Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Low Society Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, a podcast that I've been listening to for a while, Perfume Nationalist. Thank you so much for coming. Would you like to sort of introduce yourself to our audience, let them know a little bit about what you do, who you are?
Hi, thanks for having me. Perfume Nationalist is a podcast my brother and I have been doing for about 2 years now. And we pair discussions of perfumes with historically relevant media, whether that's movies, usually books, soap operas, music sometimes, really whatever. It's just wide-ranging conversations about those things.
That was the thing that I found the most striking about the podcast, was sort of the aesthetic kind of values of it, and also the fact that you kind of stir everyone's interest in perfume again, as well as like a lot of other intellectual proclivities. And it got me thinking about the perfumes that like shaped my like youth, because I started getting into like girly, feminine, blah 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 when I was in my teen years, and I realized that a lot of the tastes of the perfumes that I have are still rooted in my like early teens and 20s. So I'm looking for a more mature scent at the moment.
Right.
But like all the scents that I have tried that have been more mature, my partner like reacts too badly, because heterosexual men are like simple creatures.
They don't like when girls smell like anything. They also don't like when girls wear a bunch of makeup either. Straight men really hate makeup. Gay men love it. Yeah.
I would rather dress and like peacock for gay men, because straight men don't give a fuck and they can't tell the difference.
Right. It's depressing. I realized that I have the same perfume, like, or perfume quote unquote tastes from like my childhood or like adolescence as well. And I basically wear like Lynx, and that's about it. I never really think about perfumes. It's quite interesting to talk to someone like you that's like, yeah, that's like your shtick.
It's called Lynx there. Okay, it's called the Axe here. Yeah.
Yeah, or like what? It's something else in America,
Axe,
isn't it?
Axe. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
like
Axe.
He wears Lynx Africa, which is like, it's like basically a perfume. It's like a scent that like is associated with like black guys. And the fact that he wears it is just like really weird. It's like,
I didn't know that growing up. Like, it was just what my brothers wore, and they were like, you know, what I perceived as men. So I wore that deodorant, and then it just never really changed.
When Axe came out here, it smelled incredible. I remember like all the like cool guys that I had crushes on, their hoodies and everything smelled like Axe, and I thought that they were really, they smell really enchanting and clean and wonderful. And then Axe, of course, in general, like cologne use became the butt of jokes on like NBC sitcoms and everything. So people are always like, the smog of Axe. Well, Axe smells great. You know, Luca Turin, who's one of the big like fathers of perfume criticism, has a great saying that like cheap stuff, the only purpose it serves is to smell good, you know, since it doesn't have status associated with it.
It's true. Well, White Boy Summer has been trending recently, and I wondered if you had a scent that you would pair with White Boy Summer.
Oh, gosh. I haven't thought of it. I've been wearing, actually, speaking of Axe, I've been wearing Cool Water a lot, Davidoff Cool Water, which, that and Dracar Noir were imitated more widely by more perfumes for 20 years than like any other men's scent. So any body wash or men's deodorant or whatever, it's either a knockoff of Dracar Noir or Cool Water. Cool Water kicked off the aquatic trend of the 90s of like melon, oceanic, clean smelling stuff, but it's slightly ahead of that, and it's more like bitter and elegant. It's a lot better than the later excesses of the aquatic genre. So yeah, Cool Water. It's cheap. It's timeless. Everybody thinks it smells great, and they're a little surprised because they recognize the name when you say what it is, because they think, oh, that's sleazy. But you know, Cool Water is excellent.
Oh, excellent. So you've heard it here on Low Society. Cool Water is the scent of White Boy Summer. Go out and get yourself some right away.
So you can get big 6.8 ounce bottle for $30.
Wow. It's clearly like your hobby, so it's like you're gonna like invest in this and whatever. But like, how do you do this? Because like, my brother is also quite into like I guess, perfumes and whatever, and like colognes and stuff. But he has like, you know, that's built over years and years, just like this like collection of, like, so got this shelf and whatever. Do you like get loads of little sampler bottles, or you know a guy that you just, so you get a cheeky off the back of the truck just to get you a discount?
My black market perfumes that come in a van. No, I don't bother with samples anymore. You know, I really never did. A big part of the fun of buying perfume is blind buying. So yeah. I'll just decide that I like something from reading about it and then order the largest size possible blind. And I'm not like rich either or anything. It's just part of the thrill.
Damn.
A lot of people, you know, I don't have the impulse to gamble at all. I have no interest in gambling. That's the one vice I don't have. But I will, like, you know, spend a good bit of money on a perfume I've only read about and never smelled because I've already decided that I like it. And even wow. if I don't like it at first, you know, I'll keep it around and forget about it and then pick it up later when I'm bored. But yeah, it's years and years. I guess I've been, like, officially into, like, perfume and the history of it for about 13, 14 years now. I've been collecting. I use up tons of it, but it takes a really long time to use up a bottle of perfume.
Yeah.
It's an affordable luxury. People think of it as this like excessive thing, but actually, you know, if you spend $120 on a bottle of Chanel that takes you like several years to use up, even if that's your only scent, that's a really affordable luxury compared to.
I think you've made me like brave, because there's this perfume called Black Jade that I've been wanting to try. It's sort of based on one of Marie Antoinette's scents. And I was watching a documentary about Marie Antoinette, and they sort of talked about this perfume, and it was like one of the last sort of personal perfumes that she had written down before her death, and some French perfumers created it. So for Christmas this year, I was like, oh, I'm going to like treat myself. I'm going to buy myself a bottle of this Black Jade. But I was afraid of buying it because it's so expensive and I can't smell it. So I was like, what if I don't like it? You know, like that kind of thing. But then again, you're right. It's like it's not so expensive to be extravagant, but it's kind of like, oh, I feel a bit naughty. Mm. Like I feel kind of cheeky.
The way you framed it as well is like, it's definitely because like that Black Jade stuff, I was going to take the gamble to like buy you that, but if like me buying it for you, that is then a gamble, whereas you like buying it, that's kind of like an exciting am I gonna like it or not kind of thing, whereas I'm like,
buy
oh
it
God,
for
really
her it's so nice
like
when people give you perfume. No, just buy it for her. Like, you know, before the 50s, women didn't buy themselves perfume. Like Estee Lauder Youth Dew was sold as a bath oil. And that made it acceptable for women to buy perfume for themselves rather than have a man give it to them. But, like, I remember every single perfume that my boyfriend has given to me, I just, like, treasure. Because I love, you know, the guts it takes to select something for someone. And it's a nice
gift. It's true. Because with Jake, he doesn't give a fuck whatsoever, and like every year his mom or someone will get him like a bottle of David Beckham perfume and it just like it just doesn't go with his personality, because it's what you would expect a bunch of like lads down the pub to smell like, not what you would expect like a music engineer hippie stoner guy to smell like. So like, do you have any recommendations for what I could douse him with? I was gonna, you know, because my brothers love Paco Rabanne, but it's a bit too gentlemanly for someone like Jake, in my opinion. And then I've always had an affinity for Chanel Blue, but again, it's too bougie. Like, do you have like any scent that you would recommend that's kind of casual and hippie like?
Okay. I know a lot about hippie like, because my first scent that I, you know, chose for myself, I started wearing patchouli when I was 13 or 14. So I got used to the hippie comments of others really, really early on. But like, in terms of like foolproof classic choices for something that's more interesting than the usual department store stuff, but still something that like people who aren't into the weirdest dungeon depths of perfume strangeness yet would appreciate. Chanel Antaeus is a classic, wonderful men's scent that would be great on a woman too. It's from the 80s. Chanel Egoiste, the original Egoiste, not Platinum Egoiste, though that's okay. It's kind of generic, but they're not that expensive. They're like $80. Order them from the Chanel website. Like, any guy would be great. The original Polo Green is a foolproof 80s panty dropper.
My dad used to, like, I saw he used to wear that, because I remember seeing, like,
smells like ashtrays and pine and patchouli.
It's hot.
You know, it was associated with preps when everyone was wearing it in the 80s, but now nobody wears it. So it's intense hippie innate nature comes through, because it's just, like, smoke, pine, patchouli. It's very, a lot of modern niche fragrances are a lot like Polo.
Hell yeah, I do respond to cologne. So long as it doesn't cover up the pheromones, but Chanel Blue is like burned into my brain because the guy that I lost my virginity to used to wear it like all the time.
I know. One of my first boyfriends wore Fahrenheit, and I love Fahrenheit, but I still can't like disassociate it from him. And that was like 12 years ago.
12 years. Mm. Also, what have there been any ads as well that have, because I'm not like, I like to think that I'm like this like cool, like I'm not susceptible to advertisement kind of person, but the one perfume ad that got me was the Miss Dior ad from, I think it was 2007 thereabout. It had that Brigitte Bardot song in it, and it was like this like Parisian girl like eating macaroons and like riding her bicycle.
Sofia Coppola directed that.
Yes, she did, didn't she? Uh-huh. Yes, she did. Oh my god, I'm such a basic bitch. Like, I'm ashamed of myself.
I love Sofia Coppola too. No, I'm a basic bitch.
I can't help it. Yeah.
You know, people hate on Lost in Translation these days, but I still think it's quite enchanting. I'm like, I want to be ScarJo in Japan. You know? But she's great. Yeah.
She is. I watch the Marie Antoinette film every spring. It's like become a ritual type of thing. But that ad was the first perfume ad I saw where I was like, I have to buy that perfume. And I always like to think of myself as someone who's like not really susceptible to like lifestyle marketing and like perfume ads and stuff. That and also J'adore ad with Charlize Theron, where she's like, gold is cold, diamonds
are dead.
Coming
out of that gold water or something.
Yeah. I was like, she's so fierce. I want to like fucking be like her. And then the third one was Dita Von Teese's perfume, because she was one of the few sort of celebrity types who actually like spent time curating the scent. I think she spent like 2 years studying French perfumers and like curating the scent, because they initially just sort of gave her this sort of factory made like perfume and
celebrity
we're just gonna slap your name a celebrity scent, and she refused, and she was like, I'm gonna actually like do that. And then obviously like Dita Von Teese is the type of woman every woman wants to be like, so I was like, yeah, I'm gonna buy that.
And
I'm
she's really into perfume. Like, she's always talked about perfume a lot in interviews, and she has really exotic tastes. Like, she likes a lot of the ones that I like Lancome Magie Noir from the 70s, which is a really really weird one. But this ad thing, I always wanted to smell those Dita ones, but they never got distribution in the US. Like, I never saw one in a store anywhere. But she clearly put a lot of work into it. Sarah Jessica Parker is another celebrity who's like really into scent and, put a lot of care into hers and like talks about scent in interviews a lot.
Also, what flavor of white are you? Are you Italian, Irish? Any like weird heritage there?
No, it's totally boring. I'm totally East Texas white trash, like two generations away. Like, yeah, two generations away from like farm shacks. And then my grandparents were all just like teachers, school teachers in East Texas. But as far as like ethnicity, I'm just like German, English. Sometimes when I get mad, people tell me I look Asian. So I think there's some kind of like maybe like Russian type, like Asiatic type thing. But,
I see it. Yeah. I see it now.
There's nothing exciting.
It.
Everybody has these exciting ethnicities now. Everybody's like, I'm Italian. I'm Slavic. Whatever. No, I'm just the regular like Beavis and Butthead America. Like
you've not bought Texas. Into like. You've not bought into the like white hotepism, basically.
No, like, I'm not interested in any of that.
23andMe, like, you know.
No, there's nothing exciting there.
Well, like, what's the culture in terms of where you grew up around perfume and also class too? Is there like a dimension when it comes to that?
Yeah, totally. So my earliest memories of perfume were teachers and ladies at the Southern Baptist church that I went to wearing like Amarige and Calvin Klein Eternity and like all this stuff that was very popular in the early 90s. But then perfume scent in general fell out of vogue big time gradually through the 90s and 2000s as performative allergy-based identities became popular with liberals, people used to tolerate strong scents and smells and smoke and everything in the air with total indifference. But it really became, just as we see with like dietary trends, like gluten allergies and everything, it really became just sort of a class symbol for primarily like upper class white women to say that they were allergic to fragrance. And, they see it as something lower class, something loud. And this also comes from in America is because we're a Puritan country at heart. Like you don't want to project a loud presence. It's like embarrassing to people in a way that it's not in Europe. But the way that people think about fragrance is inaccurate in so many ways. Like, they basically, their palette of smells is basically like, that reminds me of middle school, by which they mean an aquatic, or like a sort of stripper scent, by which they mean a sweet thing. but like all the weird, interesting, bizarre, bitter, deep, dark stuff that was a regular everyday occurrence in perfumery prior to the 1990s and the aquatic trend, nobody even knows about that. They just think like old lady. There's this term old lady, which isn't even accurate because today's old ladies don't wear scents like this, like Youth do or Bandit or Aromatics Elixir. But you have to kind of learn to disassociate from that idea of fragrance, of just like being associated with age. Also, you know, you have to think beyond the idea of fragrance as a tool to seduce. Like when we talk about it, it's always kind of like as a drug, as a trip, as a like a psychedelic trip that you spray on your arm that takes you to a certain time and place. So it just goes so far beyond like how fragrance ads used to be, which was all about seducing people. And, you know, you back to what you said earlier, about feeling like a rube because you responded well to the advertising. That's not anything to be embarrassed about because perfume ads used to be great. Like they're really run of the mill, like lame now because they used to be okay with selling you an aspirational lifestyle. Advertisements now are just like scolding, like kind of political scolding. But at the height of great artistic perfumes, which I see as the 1980s when stuff like Poison, Opium, Obsession, like Angel came out in the early 90s, but it's a very 80s minded scent. Like they created a whole moody, atmospheric lifestyle for you with the combination of the ads, the scents, which they didn't put out so many thoughtless scents. It was just like one big pillar release every few years. They were okay with being dark and moody, like Dior, like Fahrenheit and Dune. They have like really creepy ads. Like now it's just this basic sort of like, she's an independent woman, but still she wants to wear this pink perfume. It's always pink, you know?
Yeah. But no,
like it's, the ads are a part of it. It's the part of the like time and place and world that you create through the magic of the most inexplicable sense, the sense of smell.
So I guess I got two questions off the back of that. Like what, so what's your favorite perfume out of all time? And then also what's, cause it seems like they kind of go through phases. So what's kind of your favorite decade or phase of perfume as like 60s or 70s, 90s? Sounds like it was like totally like renaissance of all sorts of new things happening. So what would be your favorite?
My favorite perfume of all time is Clinique Aromatics Elixir, which is from the, it's from 1972, and it's the original Clinique scent, and it was coming off the, like, kind of rich hippie trend for patchouli and musk and earthy smells, and it's a crazy psychedelic scent. You would probably recognize the smell. It's a heavy herbal astringent rose patchouli, but it was charmingly intended as like a psychedelic experience for those who wore it, and it's still available. It's cheap. It's my favorite of all time. It's if I were to choose one fragrance to represent me, it would be that. And that's the first episode we ever did was called Problematics Elixir after talking about Problematics Elixir.
Nice. The one thing that's really ironic though is the one time that Jake has ever responded to a perfume that I wore badly, it was the same kind of psychedelic patchouli. Like it's called Karma, and it's from Lush. I don't know.
Oh, if you I love Lush Karma.
Yeah, it's Lush Karma. It literally smells like what I imagined like 60s London would smell like. Mm-hmm. And I loved the bottle. The bottle was what sort of drew me to it. The art on it, and the sort of old fashioned like vintage style to it. And it was just like right up my street, and I wore it, and he was like, "Can you not do that, please?" Like it smells.
He's not gonna like Angel then.
He does. No, he likes. He responds well to like, floral girly scents or whatever. So if I wear like, I have an uncle who gets me Marc Jacobs Daisy every year since I was like 15 for Christmas. So if I wear stuff like that, he loves Miss Dior. He loves like anything with orange blossom as like a note in there. Like I take note of like, and I'm also quite old fashioned as well because I tend to copy a lot of my mom's beauty rituals just instinctively. I wear like a chemise to bed, and I wear perfume to sleep as well. And like it's like I take note of like what he responds to, but like you said, it's wasted on heterosexual men. He's just like, It smells like flowers, it smells pretty, and that like
I get so excited if I get to smell anything on anyone at all. Like I'm not any kind of like snob. It's so rare that I get to smell fragrance on another person. So I love anytime I get to smell it, but Karma is great. I prefer it as a soap. I like the I'm a big fan of like perfume soaps, and I love the big orange cakes of Karma soap that they make.
Yes, and also
the solid. I used to wear the solid all the time, mixed with Kiehl's Musk before I was really into fragrance.
Well, I'm of Nigerian and heritage, and I'm like a third generation immigrant to the UK, and a lot of the Nigerian migrants to the UK kind of come from like the Nigerian sort of middling gentry kind of class, and so perfume was always sort of seen as like a sign of status, especially like in the Western world that they were sort of immigrating to, and there was like stigma around being African, so there was always like the idea of buying the perfumes that were the most opulent or had the most sort of class associated with them. So my mom and my aunties, like, you know, they would always have like a huge, like the biggest sort of volume impossible of like Chanel number 5. Like that is like that scent is like ingrained into my brain. Like I'll never be able to
paradise. I love it.
Like
what other scents were popular with them?
So my mom also was a huge fan of J'adore. She loved J'adore. Mm-hmm. She loved Agua de Jo as well, which I wear now because I love it. Like I feel like it's one of the scents that best represents me. Agua de Jo is beautiful, just lovely, fresh kind of scent to it. Anything Givenchy was also like a big thing, but it was all these like really expensive, opulent, high class, quote unquote, perfumes, but in the gaudy sense, if you know what I mean, like in like the mall kind of sense, if you know what I mean.
Those are all the ones that I like because I am just really not interested in stuff that doesn't make a strong statement usually.
Yeah.
I mean, now as I'm running out of things to be into, I kind of appreciate more like light eau de cologne type stuff if I'm in the mood for that. But all the stuff that I really treasure is like love it or hate it personality scents that make a strong statement. And it's funny that you bring up Miss Dior because I actually like placed this big Dior order this week. And the Miss Dior you're talking about is, well, first it was released as Miss Dior Cherie as a flanker. And then they renamed it Miss Dior, but it's like a fruitually like more modern thing, but the original Miss Dior from the 40s. I just ordered a bottle of that, and it's a green Shepra fragrance, and it smells like marijuana. It's amazing. It used to be really popular. But yeah, I opened the box, and it just smelled like pot right from the start, like extreme sage, vetiver, patchouli thing. And this was associated with like elegant, kind of tight ass upper class ladies. It's just amazing how like the scent signals change.
Yeah, change. And that's the reason why I really kind of am interested in perfume, is because it's one of the primary areas where lifestyle marketing is like super obvious. And I mean, I have my skepticisms about lifestyle marketing, especially now as we are like in this super alienated, like atomized age, and like people are sort of, they cleave onto lifestyle marketing as like a way of escaping some of the cultural norms that are established through, you know, our material conditions in that sense. And you see it a lot, like not just in perfume, but like on Twitter. You see it in podcasting as well. I'm all in favor of the aesthetic domain. I wouldn't necessarily call myself an aesthete. It's not, I'm more of like somebody who's interested in like the emotional dimension, blah, blah, blah. But I do appreciate the aesthetic dimension, but I feel like there's something kind of weird and cold about the Apollonian impulse to reduce all things to aesthetic, or reduce all things to lifestyle marketing in that sense. And I think it also goes along with the times that we're in. We live in like super hyper capitalist culture and civilization. What do you think about this? And have you sort of seen lifestyle marketing as like cope in the kind of way that I'm addressing?
So by lifestyle marketing, like what specifically in reference to like today do you mean? Just like Instagram influencer type, that sort of stuff?
So there's the lifestyle marketing in terms of like the Instagram influencer stuff, but there's lifestyle marketing in terms of like distilling affect. Mm-hmm. And you see it happen a lot with like the genders. So you'll have like a dude, like for women, there's like the dudes rock, pick me. And then there's right. the, you know, like histrionic, like e-girl, or there's like the above it all smart academic, or, yeah. you know, all these sort of ways that people sort of distill affect in a way to sort of rebel against what they view as like the deficits of modernity. What do you think about this kind of trend?
Right. So in the way that that intersects with perfume, I think my interest in perfume as it intersects with other art, media, aesthetics, culture is mainly as historical preservation, because I see the 2010s and 2010s liberalism as being a movement to erase history and censor and kind of stigmatize the past, make it so that everything in the past is bad, especially anything with a strong creative nature to it. In terms of the way, like the extreme, like niche kind of lifestyle stuff that people choose, and the weird signifiers that everyone chooses, and like the Twitter communities that we inhabit, I think that it's kind of a natural product of mainstream media failing us. And it's generally a good thing. Like, you know, there's a stigma around podcasts, and people are like, podcasts, anyone can do that. Anyone can talk into a mic. But the important thing about it is that it's free from the corrupt, decadent, dinosaur corporate media structure that is just lying to us every day. So, yeah, you can make a bad podcast where you're just talking into a mic, but also it's still one of the last kind of Wild Wests where people can say what they want. That's, you know, they're already kind of doing the moral panic about podcasts for that reason, saying misinformation is being spread on podcasts because it's not being regulated by us, the media and the government. So that's probably not going to last that much longer. But yeah, in terms of like reducing everything to cold aesthetic signifiers, I agree. Like my sort of vision of that is, you know, is combined with my kind of Christian American emotionalism, But like one of my favorite books, he's Mons Against Nature, about this like aesthete that, you know, sequesters himself with all of his books and perfumes and everything to get away from the horror of modernity. And he just becomes sicker and sicker. Like, that's also true. You have to like interact with the world in like a healthy way, you know?
That's kind of what I was getting at, I guess, in a less verbose and annoying fashion, I guess. In what I see really is a kind of like overreach sometimes in certain sequesters of like that Apollonian instinct, to use like Pahlia-ish language, in terms of reducing things to the cold kind of aesthetic signifier. And creating a sort of cultivating a market demographic like through that. And obviously I'm very much in favor of tradition, and I also see how the current liberal paradigm erodes and disrespects tradition and attempts to erase history and sees history as this kind of reactionary force. It's kind of caught up in the whole kind of postmodern, like post-structuralist kind of, you know, paradigm in that sense. But then I feel like the reaction to that that you see sometimes is also equally as like ridiculous sometimes. Like there's this kind of... it's not like developing an authentic personality, because I feel like developing an authentic personality is about taking elements of what suit you and what you feel resonance with in a way that's like true and authentic. But you see a lot of people who sort of are like kind of posturing with traditional aesthetics or values in a way that's inauthentic, and that would ultimately make them unhappy if they actually
adhered to. 100%. Totally. Because, like, so many of those people, like, spouting off about tradition are not interacting with the real world or the present day in any honest way. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's always bothered me about that sort of Twitter scene, and why I've always, in my work, sought to include details of the reality of my life that's just like unglamorous. I'm just like a hospitality worker, just like doing this for fun to preserve some kind of like creative interest. But I've never liked the world of like airtight personas that people use on Twitter. I really just like real normal people that are interacting with the present day in an honest way, rather than LARPing. But yeah, this obsession with tradition, where it spins off into like, I'm entitled to like a girl who's both virginal and horny, and also I'm gonna be able to buy a house by 24. Like these ridiculous expectations of just like trying to go back in time and live a life that nobody can no longer live, like that's useless.
For sure. And I mean, we're all atomized consumers now. And, you know, this sort of secular kind of modernity doesn't really provide much in terms of food for the soul. So a lot of it is kind of built in a yearning for something more meaningful than just capitalism and like consumption in that sense. Like people want something. So I understand the impulse, but people always end up going to like the opposite, like extreme, especially like women online. It's sad when I see the way that women online try to sort of fit themselves in these digital anima kind of slots. It's like, is this all there is? Like it's sad that is this all there is, that you either have to like be a dude's rock bitch that like basically, you know, reifies the teenage rebellion of like young men, or you're like they're like, you know, big titted waifu, or you're this or you're that. It's like, is this all there is? And a lot of women sort of embrace it because it replaces their urge or instinct for communal self-sacrifice, a social role, and the ability to sort of connect with people. Like there's that kind of thing where they say that women are on average more interested in people than they are in things. And it seems as if like a lot of women these days tend to, you know, portray or project those instincts into these sort of alienated, atomized digital realms. What do you think about this?
That's a problem for gays too. I kind of subscribe to the Victorian idea that gays are like men with women's brains in their bodies, you know. That's a problem with gays too, because like, now that regular cisgender homosexuals are not a useful minority for the Democrat Party, and not really even there's kind of a contempt for regular gays these days too. But if you become like sort of, you know, red-pilled, as they say, gays from the alienated from the LGBTQ plus acronym, you know, which is just a wing of a propaganda wing of the Democrat Party, where you're expected to, you know, kind of just be a woman or a gender queer, whatever, spiritually or physically, they run to the opposite end and they adopt these like humorless masculine performance personas where, you know, where they're wearing like the trucker cap and like completely humorless about any kind of like gay culture that could be seen as feminine or queenie or whatever. And those guys are like not fun either. There's, I think in the online communities we're talking about, there's this impulse for contrarianism, extreme contrarianism that harms it overall and prevents people from presenting themselves as just a fully fleshed, complicated person, because it's always jumping to the next hottest take. It's always abandoning what becomes seen as popular or cringe before it's even really popular. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, six people can be doing something and then it's declared, oh, that's so over. Like, I was like name searching a few weeks ago and I saw someone talk about like, oh, there was a time when perfume nationalism was a thing, talking about like, it's like nobody knows what the perfume nationalist is now. It's this obscure thing, you know? But they're already talking about it in this over it tone. But yeah, that impulse for contrarianism really prevents people from being normal, you know?
Yeah. And like, that's another thing. I mean, I don't like it's, I think it's also linked to the fact that we're all encouraged to market ourselves and like these sort of sacred internal identities. That depends on if you view identity in that way, which I tend not to. Well, the way that we're encouraged to view identity is as if it's the sacred, like internal reality and that it make there something like essential about, you know, certain things or whatever. And, you know, that doesn't, it's not real. Like the thing that exists now is like consumption paths and consumer demographics. Like I say it all the time about the Black community, for instance, like there was once upon a time an actual Black community, but now the Black community is just a consumer demographic. And I feel it goes the same way with a lot of like communities of identity are really not communities because community in general is like been so deeply eroded by like the forces of like neoliberal capitalism. Like it's no longer, we're no longer socially embedded subjects. Like we're atomized consumers. And especially when it comes to stuff like sexuality, I feel not just for gay people, but for straight people too. I feel like so much of sexuality is like divorced from the body now. And it's all about consumption signifiers and feeling as if you're part of a quote unquote community and signaling to that community and all of those things. It's not really about like fucking and like who you fuck anymore. Mm-hmm.
Well, no, it's all about your niche interests. It's all about your fucking like weird categories that end up becoming way more frequent in your fucking Pornhub tab. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, there's not a trace of organic like, sexuality about it, you know?
No.
Not a single, but the internet allows people to create this perfect snapshot of the exact thing that they're trying to portray, if you know what I mean. Even if it's like not them at all. I think I even remember seeing one of these like Korean ethots was actually just like some 35-year-old like dude who wore like a wig and pushed up some stuff in his top and but with the face tune and the AI tuning and all that weird stuff that they've got over there, he was it made it look like a pretty Korean woman, but it wasn't. It was a pretty burly bloke when all the cameras were off or all the robots stopped working.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing, though. Within a couple of years, like AI influencers and like CGI influencers are going to replace all of these sort of histrionic people because it's impossible to sort of sustain that kind of like. It's not possible to be a perfect quote unquote influencer. Like even with a small, tiny amount of eClout I have, like I struggle and people hate you, you're constantly having to watch what people are saying about you, and you get canceled every fucking 5 minutes, and you as a human being like will break down eventually and feel tired and burnt out. And it's easier to have something, since we're in this sort of silicon, like completely digitized age where the Apollonian eye has gone rogue. That's where I would totally challenge Paliya, even though I have no right to challenge Paliya because I'm like not an academic and I'm just like a dum-dum. But I feel like this is the natural kind of result of the Apollonian eye. It sort of divorces aesthetics from experience and divorces aesthetics from the body. And that's the reason why I love perfume, because yes, it's opulent and it's aesthetic, but it's so intrinsically about the body. And it's like a marriage of aesthetics and the body in a way that like a lot of these other things aren't.
Yeah, absolutely. And a common misconception, you know, I think that people have, especially conservatives right now, is that we're living in this like sexually decadent libidinous age, which is 100% false. We are living in the most puritanical anti-sex period in human history. I genuinely, sincerely believe that there has never been a time in human history where basic sexual functions, any kind of libido, all of it was this stigmatized and with this like religious, secular religious terror about it. And this is the combination, it's coming from both sides, mainly from liberalism, which people don't understand, because there's this clinical, like theoretical academic support for like ostensible sexual freedom in these like, as you said, little like fetish categories, but that's not real sexuality. That's an S&M game in itself. Like COVID is a BDSM game. Paliya is right that like at the end of a civilization, people are doing S&M, sadomasochism, and like gender fluidity stuff. And I see like COVID and all of the ceremonies around that as a form of sadomasochism, because everyone is so sexually repressed, because the only way that we see sex represented in society at all is as blackmail, as something used against people, like coming from Me Too. And even before that, the kind of hyped up campus rape, moral panic epidemic, there's just like no positive feeling about actual sexuality at all right now. It's tied up in these bureaucratic trappings that just make it something people want to avoid, so they go deeper into their computers.
Jack, how can you say we're so sexually repressed when all anyone's been talking about is some fucking black guy twerking on the fucking devil and, you know, for the last 2 weeks now? Come on.
That's like accepted stuff, though. Like,
saying. Last week we did an episode on the Little Nas S thing, and it's not as if, you know, homosexuality and Satanism like are raising too many eyebrows these days. It's not really subversive. But what you're saying about people escaping further into the digital realm and further away from the body, where I disagree with Paliya is I feel like that is the sort of end result of what happens when the Apollonian eye goes too far. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Western culture specifically, this like brutish Apollonian gaze is so relentless in its pursuit for the highest and most refined ideals, that it kind of makes people despise themselves. And, you know, it used to, the Apollonian gaze, when it was like sort of placed upon Africans and more Dionysian cultures, was like, you know, made black people hate themselves, and, you know, it was racism. But now it's gotten to the point where actual Westerners are turning the Apollonian gaze inward, and it's making them hate themselves. The Apollonian gaze is like relentless, it doesn't stop. And these sort of distilled forms of like opulence and beauty and decadence solely trapped within the digital realm is what I feel happens when the Apollonian gaze like goes too far, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's interesting that you classify it as Apollonian. I see the current sex panic as Dionysian, and, you know, Paliya's polarity is male Apollonian and female Dionysian, and the Thonian swamp is like female sexual insanity and everything, and maternal, mysterious, organic stuff. And I see, you know, Me Too and the current kind of crucible witch hunt type panics around any trace of sexuality as a misplaced female Dionysian insane sexual urge, and then the resulting like rules and bureaucracy surrounding it is this attempt to control that.
I feel like it is Apollonian in the sense that it's the it's like the female attempting to take on the Apollonian role to succeed in an Apollonian world and an Apollonian environment, because the Apollonian gaze is about revolt against nature, and sexuality is inherently bound up within the Dionysian, the body, nature. So I see this sort of move towards Puritanism and a despise of all that is organic, and this sort of hyper obsession with refined beauty in the sort of digital realm as like intrinsically Apollonian. But I could be wrong because, you know, I'm not.
I'm like the meme of the woman with the math problems, you know. Now. But Apollonian, Dionysian, Thonian. I mean, the only way out of this is no one will stand up for basic male sexuality. Like, at all. The only people doing that are gay men, and that's why people hate gay men. And only a select few gay men are doing that. It seems like no straight men will just say no. Like, people, like, conservative talking heads will, like, buy into the premise of the more excessive aspects of Me Too and Me Too as a whole. Like, no one will call this stuff what it is. They feed it by every time a new 35-year-old celebrity comes out and like retcons one of their relationships as grooming or whatever. Nobody will just say, this is not real. This is not a real thing that people should be worrying about. Evan Rachel Wood, Marilyn Manson, this is ridiculous that anyone has to even spend time with this. And that furthermore, like pretending not to recognize the pattern that it's all like celebrities aging out of like the youth demographic where they're cast as leading roles, and now it's just this path to press attention, and everybody's like, no, there's actually the epidemic of rape that's just striking actresses, and it's like nobody will stand up for male sexuality at all.
But straight men can't contribute to that conversation, because the only time straight men do come into a conversation in a public way, like in the media at the moment, is around like rape or something terrible. There's it's they're seen as the dominant or like hegemonic sexuality. And it's similar to like whiteness. So like, you know, white people can't say stuff about, you know, a lot of shit because no one wants to hear that, especially, you know, straight white people.
Which is stupid, obviously. There's like a fear and like a reluctance in a lot of them because they've been browbeaten. And especially, like I said, like women are now behaving more like men in order to succeed in that sense. So and not just more like men, they're sort of taking the worst aspects of masculinity, like the arrogance, the dominance, all of that stuff, because they're like, oh, in a jungle full of predators, I may as well be the predator and not the prey. So you women are like basically taking on like the worst aspects of hegemonic masculinity, and I feel like a lot of men really aren't like that, so it's like there's a whole new class of like dominant male posturing that they have to contend with as well, not just the way they have to contend with among other men, but now they're having to contend with women in the same way, which is a thing that I'm noticing, which is why they're like afraid to say anything, because they don't want to get like, even if a woman can't physically overpower them, they could do something heinous to their career, or you know, do something that affects their life in like a different kind of devastating way.
I mean, it's resulted in men just being terrified of women and terrified of working around women, anything, because any misstep or even not a misstep on your part, because it's gone so far out into this like psychedelic outer realm where a woman can just decide at any point that anything was was grooming or abuse or any, like, it's just like so much of it is just made up. But like, when you say that, like, women are so often imitating like what they think male managers and stuff and like powerful men do, that's so true, because like a lot of like bad woman managers think that like being like competent and as good as a man just means like randomly issuing orders and, you know, pulling rank. And like, if you have like a good male manager, they don't do that. Like, the, like, good managers know when not to insert themselves to incur like wrath and resentment from their employees. They know when to leave stuff alone. But like, a lot, it's like people go to some seminar, like woman managers go to some seminar that tells them this really bad information about how to like just interject and pull rank at every point to
lean in.
To lean in,
you know, it's, and it just makes everyone miserable. It makes everyone resent them in the workplace.
But men are also guilty of this kind of histrionic behavior.
Oh yeah, it's true.
Because now what you see is men taking on aspects, the worst aspects of femininity as well, because they see, a lot of men see women as like the protected class and resent a lot of the sort of protections and free passes that women get. So they'll take on really toxic aspects of like of traditional femininity, like being materialistic or being backbiting and bitchy, or having these like sort of impossible catty bitchy beauty standards, or like, you know, just like stuff that I learned to not do when I was like 16 and like maturing, and like all those sort of girlish behaviors. So you have a lot of men who sort of have taken on, in order to sort of counteract the sort of toxic masculinity that women are portraying in the world, you see men also taking on aspects of like toxic femininity too.
Absolutely. And like trying to solve everything through bureaucratic official interference is a big part of that. Like, the liberal mindset is such that no problem can be solved on a personal human, you know, interpersonal level. It always has to be running to some higher authority and changing it through social engineering or an official police crackdown. And when men imitate that sort of behavior and like are running to the HR department to negotiate mild conflicts and stuff like that, which is, you know, to be fair, that's the atmosphere that's been created in the modern workplace. And that's, it's hard to know how to negotiate anything because there's just this terror of doing anything wrong. But like, any good manager I've ever had was like on the level and would deal with the problem person to person rather than just sending out emails, sending out these impersonal kind of like company-wide emails, but you know, when it's about one particular person, just this goes back to whatever horrible, god-awful management manual they're using now that telling people to like negotiate this all through abstract, incessant emailing and whatever. It's awful. It's it just makes people resent other people. It makes them resent managers. It makes them resent having to work at all. It's just so fake.
Well, because it's, I mean, no one likes to be in a position, like have a position of authority over them, basically. And if someone can just come and level with them in a really like personable, human-like way, instead of like through this sort of like machine and like operation and everything to kind of like make it part of the official business and whatever, it kind of, do you know what I mean? It always yields a much better result.
That's kind of a more quote-unquote traditionally masculine way of approaching problems. Like, there's that whole thing about like men will have an argument and they'll fucking beat each other up and then they'll be down the pub drinking like an hour later or whatever and they've sorted out their problem. Whereas there's the idea that women have this sort of vindictive streak that, and we like sort of, and I've been I'm a girl, I went to boarding school, I've been subject to like female psychological bullying before. I also had a lot of female cousins as well. And it's very different from the way that like men boys bully each other, which is about dominance and like, you know, physicality usually. But with women, there's this like, and the thing is, a lot of people account for toxic femininity and they say that, you know, oh, the only reason that it exists is because it's this reaction to patriarchy. But I disagree. I think there are certain weird cultures that, you know, women evolved for themselves throughout the centuries that have to do with like intra-sexual, like, you know, competition and all of those different things. But there is such a thing as toxic femininity, and it's really poisonous. Anyone who grew up around girls like knows exactly what it is.
I think you're abstracting the male experience out of the modern day context there a little bit. How? As well, because I mean, so in the best case scenario, that's exactly what happens. Like, you know, a little tussle happens, and then you have a drink, and then it's all forgotten and it's water under the bridge. But like in today's litigious kind of like culture, that's not what happens. Like some a tussle happened. Oh, I'm getting an Uber home. Oh my god, did you get his name? Yeah. Oh my god, I'm gonna fucking like send this to my lawyer. Yeah. And then he's like, and then you execute that soft power from the no, because like that, I mean, that's just the fucking way of the world these days, isn't it? That is like what it happens.
Becoming less, the direct approach is a more traditionally masculine approach. It has nothing to do with like gender or what you identify as. It's in terms of like the culture that men have had for thousands of years, the more direct approach is seen as more masculine. Whereas like, it's like in the court of like royal kings, if you wanted to kill an opponent or a rival, it was considered like feminine to poison them. Like they would make fun of a man who poisoned, but it was considered honorable to actually go and face your opponent in battle kind of thing. They used to say like poison is a woman's weapon sort of thing, like that indirect soft power way. But you see a lot of men employing that sort of indirect soft power, which can be useful and good in certain contexts in terms of keeping peace and things like that. But in certain contexts, it can be so fucking insidious. And I feel like because there's such an over-focus on like toxic masculinity, people forget how monstrous the feminine can also be as well.
Which you can observe so plainly. Yeah. If you, yeah. Like I've worked in primarily female workplaces. Like yeah, I edited erotica for 3 years, and there were no men in management, there was barely any men around. And then I worked at a primarily like woman run woman managed hotel, and just the way that a lot of meddling is done, and there's a certain quintessentially female like maternal impulse to kind of like herd people around like kindergartners, which serves its purpose in nature. You know, child rearing, there are many beautiful manifestations of this, but it can also be like perverted in such a horrible way in the modern workplace, where you just incur resentment by inserting yourself into situations where you didn't need to do anything. And it's like working hard, not smart. You know, it's making everything more complicated for everyone. But there was always a kind of like, you know, as a gay, I'm gossipy too, obviously. But like, there was always a kind of like atmosphere whenever there was like a problem person that, you know, that was decided to be the target of everyone's kind of wrath in the workplace. It would be a literally like 9 month period of everyone talking behind their back. And then finally it would burst and someone would go to an authority, and then a company-wide email, blanket punishment type email would be sent out. It's just this sort of thing. You see it like really easily.
Well, like people have forgotten, like people focus too much on like the devouring father, that kind of Saturnian archetype, and they forget like the devouring mother also exists. And like, it's funny because nature is the devouring mother who like she gives us and she fucking replenishes us, but she also inevitably consumes us. And like people, because we have this impulse in Western culture to sort of push the Dionysian away, push nature away, push death away, push decay away, push, you know, all of those aspects of the consumptive aspects away. We also, I see that reflected in the way that like the modernity treats women. Women are sort of seen as this sort of ideal of morality and of gentleness, and people sort of forget about the fact that left to our own devices, we'll like devour you. Like it's instinctual. Yeah. We want to turn men into fucking babies at our breasts. Like it's, and there's that kind of darker aspect.
And like every guy who works under a female manager can relate to this. It's something I joke about a lot, but the manifestations of that like corrupted maternal instinct and the desire to make men into like eternal babies that you can kind of herd around, they, whenever they want to reward you or reward, you know, like a 33-year-old man in the workplace, they'll give you cookies. They'll give you sweets. like a baby. And it's such an insult. It's like, I mean, people like talk about like, joke about like husbands giving wives vacuum cleaners for Christmas. Imagine being like a 33-year-old man and you're rewarded. Your life comes to like cookies.
Oh, but some of the thing is like, the thing is that is as infantilizing as that is, there are so many men these days that welcome that kind of infantilization because they're like Oedipal. They're like, they, yeah, like a lot of men, yeah, are, and the culture in general is Oedipal. Like, and you see symbols of it all the time. Like, I don't know if you saw the like that Resident Evil meme that was going around with like the big giant mommy lady with like, yeah, the huge tits and like, this sort of, it shows this sort of desire to be dominated by the tyrannical feminine. And then even the digital realm in and of itself is like a chthonic feminine realm. And like the fact that they want to enter it, all of their libidinal energy is being directed into it. They're being devoured. The fact that we are like atomized consumers in our little COVID bubble cocoons, we're fetal, we're Oedipal. Like, there is an Oedipal streak to the culture. That's also aided by like neoliberal capitalism. It turns everyone into a fucking fetus. Like in the Matrix, that scene where Neo wakes up and he's all the pod people and they're like fetal little babies, that is the neoliberal utopia.
Uh-huh. Well, I did see like you know, I think it was some Russian basketball player who cosplayed as that Resident Evil witch lady. And, you know, tall bitches need love too, you know? So, and if it gives them a character and, like, and there's a peaked interest in tall bitches all
of
a sudden.
You know what? He would say this because he's a slightly Oedipal, like, less than most heterosexual men, I'll give you that. But, like, his mom, like, wears white musk. And there was one time, yeah, it's cute, isn't it? There was one time where I was at my mom's house and I slept there and she had white musk. So I was coming home and I sprayed a little bit on me and came home and he was like so aroused and like, no, fucked me. Yeah, yes, you were. Yes, you were. You like fucked me. Like,
that is not true.
All men have like some little bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it works both ways. Like I used to wear nothing but like Kiehl's musk, which is a very daddy type scent. Yeah. And I would just find like random girls at parties, like nestled in my armpit, telling me how good I smelled. And Polo does the same thing. It like has the smell, yeah, of like a, yeah, a daddy, yeah, like patriarch associations. And then, you know, it works for gay men, yeah, too. Like I like the sort of thing that smells like your friend's dad is dropping you off. And you're like staring at his crotch, you know, in those like golf shorts.
Oh,
that type of smell association. Damn. But I would advise, you know, read this like Oedipal type strain and culture. Everyone should watch Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, which I feel like is, yes, the most relevant movie, yes, for today, for like, yes, men today. Yes. Because straight men literally have to become women, put on a wig and become women to deal with like their sexuality or any like male impulse, honestly. And they constantly seek to be punished by an overbearing mother figure. Like, yep, and yep, Psycho just, yep, illustrates it so perfectly. Like, yep, Hitchcock understood.
Yeah. You know? But when you start sort of talking about this kind of weird unconscious realm, people tend to react really badly to it. That's kind of been my trope on Twitter, is that I'll make these like sort of weird, like, pop psychoanalysis tweets, and then, like, 1,000 people will respond, like, you fucking bitch, because they're triggered by it agitates their unconscious demons, basically. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that this kind of thing gets a very hostile response. And I mean, of course, there's one thing to not resonate with this sort of exploration or analysis. It's another thing to feel like deeply, deeply like attacked and unsettled by it. And a lot of people do, because it's like, you know, that meme of like the possum that's like in the garbage bin and it's like, don't touch my garbage. That's like the vibe. That's like the vibe. Like if you talk about the Oedipal stuff, if you talk about the sort of deleterious negative polarity between the sexes, if you talk about any of that stuff, people get like really personally, like, you know, like upset about it, like invalidated.
They get mad if you speak in generalizations, which is necessary to be any kind of like compelling theoretical speaker, but you're kind of taught in college to use this like mealy mouth sort of like, and there are a million exceptions to everything that I say, and not everyone is like this. That goes without saying. Like I learned from Polya early enough, like the most valuable thing about Polya is learning how to communicate clearly in like declarative sentences and repeat your main ideas all the time. And like, as people go further up the academic ladder, they get into this like theory language stuff, which like serves a purpose. It's more of a hobby, but communicating clearly in like declarative sentences where you're not like apologizing for everything that you say, not saying that there are exceptions to this, that it diminishes your power as a speaker when you put these disclaimers before everything. But it's really funny that like people are so offended by these kind of like this Freudian analysis and talking about gender in any kind of like general way, all of that, because that's happening simultaneous to the mainstream obsession with daddies and like girls are all like, you know,
and mommy milkers, like, daddies. That, like, how are you?
They act
know,
like that doesn't have a source.
Yeah, and it's always leftists. It's always leftists, which annoys the shit out of me, because Freud, obviously it's stupid to say Freud was right about everything, but I don't respect any theorist who doesn't say Freud was onto something, especially if you're somebody with any kind of quote unquote anti-capitalist view, because Bernays went and took Freud's theory and modeled it into the modern sort of lifestyle marketing, lifestyle and values marketing that we see today. Like Bernays worked along with capital and industry and advertisement using these Freudian models of human psychology to market our shoes and perfume, and it has been the driving force of the 20th and 21st century. So to say that Freudian analysis has no truth to it, or that it has no theoretical value whatsoever, is really annoying. And it's kind of a problem that I see with like the Marxoid types. Nature doesn't exist, and Marxism, material analysis, as important as it is, it's only to them, it's the only form of valid analysis, and every other form of analysis is reactionary, even though yes, we are material creatures and the material conditions historically oftentimes give rise to culture. Almost always give rise to whatever cultural more, the material conditions sort of precede that. But we are also like psychological beings, we are spiritual beings, we are creative beings, we are artistic beings, and material analysis alone cannot account solely for that. And yeah, a lot of leftoids and like Marxoids get very annoyed by any form of cultural analysis that isn't purely sort of rooted in like economic or material models.
Yeah, the even if like the further out stuff about Freud, like the more intricate little relationship models he's describing, seems ridiculous to us now, it's essential to understand like the larger picture, for, as you said, to understand art, culture, commerce, anything about the 20th century because of how influential that was. But also at the most basic level, like there's the fundamental truth of like, you look at couples and like men marry women who are like their mothers, women marry men who are like their fathers, like that, like, you know, undercurrent of incestuous like theoretical desire there, and like that like familial need, like it's not something that you can just like flat out deny and replace with Marxist analysis, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And it, I mean, it goes to say that in terms of all areas of culture, which is why I think the left sort of ends up reifying a lot of the social structures that it claims to challenge a lot of the time, because there is no emphasis on this kind of psychological cultural analysis. It's just sort of raw. So they end up kind of mimicking a lot of the excesses of the culture that has arisen out of capitalism, which is what I see. You know, in terms of the way that they, you know, follow all the incentives, in terms of the logic they use, a lot of the logic they use is sort of influenced by the logic of the system they claim to oppose. And because there's not that sort of introspective nature, unless it's sort of based on like economic analysis, they end up sort of reifying a lot of the negativity you see. And a lot of the people who are into the weird Oedipal Freudian stuff online tend to be left. Like in one side they're like, oh yeah, neoliberalism is bad, we're atomized consumers, and then on the other hand they're like in their houses atomized and cocooned jerking off to Resident Evil mommy milk or porn. So you know, I see that like weird psychological disconnect, and it's also why they despise people like Jordan Peterson, even though like I don't agree with a lot of his analysis. The fact, I mean, there's some of it that I do agree with, but there's a vast amount that I don't. But there's this sort of disdain for the fact that he tells people to get their lives together, because there's sort of a renouncement of personal autonomy. And I think that you should have a form of personal autonomy paired with a form of material analysis. Otherwise, you do end up being atomized and alone and, you know, fucking, you know, completely hopeless.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I talk about it a lot, but the treatment of Jordan Peterson, someone who, regardless of whether you like him as a whole, was a net good, especially for young men at a time when they're feeling so alienated and lonely and are depicted as criminals and murderers and responsible for all of the evils that have ever taken place in history. He offered this really simple, kind of like common sense type paternal advice that's just missing from culture, and it was so thoroughly distorted into something gross. Like I even like the jokes about that were used to kind of like discredit him, where everyone pretends he said wash your dick, and like everybody has to the state mandated girlfriend stuff, which he never said.
He never said
anything like that, and it just was based on this kind of like contrarian hearsay. And I remember when he was coming on the scene, and he did that wonderful conversation with Polya, which I've watched probably like 5 times over the years.
Same.
A lot of young men don't have anyone telling them this stuff. It's really sad. But like, I'm fortunate to come from a family where my parents are still together and I was instilled with like a strong kind of like moral compass. But a lot of people, no one's ever told them that you have to like cleaning your room is good for your mental state. Like going online and reading about the systemic things that led to your oppression and your current situation, like, at a certain point, you have to stop and just, like, live a regular life and, like, be responsible for your own actions. And leftists are so allergic to this idea of being responsible for anything.
And I guess it's because historically, like, the idea of, like, personal responsibility has been used to dismiss, like, genuine inequality. So that aversion has now perverted into a total aversion and a total divorce and absconsion from the self, really. And when you look at a lot of these leftoids and you look at their lives are usually a terrible wreck, and they sort of reify the lack of responsibility that they take, because there's always a certain element you have to do your best to make yourself as happy and as psychologically healthy as possible, despite whatever economic constraints you might have. Like, I have very poor family that live in Nigeria, but they still are happy. They still try to do their best to make them. And these are people who are far less privileged than these people. But because they don't want to look at their lives and they don't want to introspect, there's this fear of introspection. I think a lot of it has to do with narcissism as well, because we do live in a culture of narcissism. But there's this fear of introspection, and they sort of use leftist theory as a way of validating it. I don't have to, because society is punishing me. Everything is society's fault. And they start to sort of project a lot of their own bullshit on society. And of course, a lot of bullshit comes from society. You can't deny it. But like, there's an element of like self-responsibility for oneself that comes into like living a healthy and fulfilled life. And I don't think, even though I don't necessarily agree with Jordan Peterson's sort of deference to the status quo, that's like where I have my issue with him, is the fact that he sort of is like, well, this is it, and trying to think about perspective anything better is like a fool's errand. But the place where I do agree with him is in the fact that you do have to take personal responsibility for yourself. Yeah. You have to wash your dick, you have to clean your room, you have to make yourself into a valuable person in order to get that sort of response from society. And you should be doing as much as you can, no matter what, to make yourself viable and healthy, and, you know, whatever it is that's within your power. But a lot of leftoids don't want to hear that. And a lot of, like, you know, cluster B kind type personalities are attracted to the left, specifically because it's like this warm Oedipal comfort blanket that tells them that they don't have to do anything, and that a real left would not want those people. Or at least a real left would try to rehabilitate those people. And
no,
it makes
one wants
me so angry.
Whiners. That's the, like nobody, regardless of where you are in the political compass, nobody wants to work with, you can't work with like whiners who make excuses for why they can't do things. It's just like,
yeah, seriously. And obviously we're not sociopaths. We're not sociopaths. Like, we wouldn't discount serious constraints. Like, only a complete asshole would do that. But there's this, like the thing you said about smells, like the DSA meeting where it was like no strong scents. Or you look at like
that was a perfect illustration of the DSA.
Yeah, literally. Literally. Yeah. Or you look at a culture like Japan, for instance, which has taken the Oedipal, atomized consumer sort of Apollonian instinct to its like extreme. And strong scents are also discouraged in Japan. I mean, in Japan, like, Japanese people won't even stand next to foreigners on the train because they view having a strong scent or smelling of anything at all as being very, very socially unacceptable, because they're so sort of atomized and sort of distant from one another that something as like a smell is considered too intimate. Like, being able, it's this aversion to human beings. It's weird.
Well, I don't know. I think in Japan as well, most people, you know, well, a lot of people taking public transport, you're squished in like sardines.
Yeah,
it's just
London's,
polite, isn't
London's
it?
The same way. And never have I been on the tube in London and be like, oh my god, this guy's cologne is like killing me.
No, but that's just the different sensibilities, isn't it? As a British person, you're like, oh fucking hell, he stinks.
But the
like,
Japanese still smoke inside. That's the funny thing there, is that like Americans are absolutely mortified of any kind of indoor smoking. To even like people who smoke are scared of like smoke getting in through the patio while you're smoking. But Japanese, it's one of the last like holdouts of indoor smoking. So there's a cultural preference for like lighter scents or no scents at all. But that shows you how subjective and cultural it is that they still smoke inside.
Yeah. Definitely. It's actually like really crazy getting to do that nowadays, because like, I mean, I've never been an adult and been able to smoke indoors anywhere, because I think that happened when I was 17. Like, yeah, that happened pretty globally, like that within the same 2 years or like whatever, within Europe and America and stuff. And I was like 17, 16. I had been smoking for a couple of years, and then bang, it came in. And I went to Austria, and it's the same thing there as well. Like, everyone's just fucking smoking indoors, or they've got whole sections and stuff. I sat in a restaurant and had a cigarette after my meal, and it was just like, this is, I feel like I'm in another world. This is so strange, but also,
I mean,
amazing.
It's paradise to me, and I don't smoke all that much, but like the smoking bans are the origin of the kind of state control of that results in like scent bans, and currently all the weird stuff that's going to stick around after COVID. like smoking bans were really an early experiment in making people into cops that work for free. Because, like, you know, I understand, you know, people who grew up around indoor smoking, boomers, a lot of them really hated it and really hated it. They don't romanticize smoking in the same way. But to not allow it in bars is really ridiculous to me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a real, like, impediment to conversation and just, like, human connection. Like, live music died because of smoking bans. Live music sucks. Like, it used to be you would, like, go and you'd smoke and you'd drink and everything, and the band would be there, and there would be this kind of, like, you know, multiple plot lines going on. Now it's everybody just goes outside to smoke cigarettes. The band doesn't matter. It killed public life.
Yeah. Do you know what's even worse now is that everyone else will stay indoors drinking their fucking coffee, smoking a vape because they can do that indoors, and then fucking Muppet here then has to go out on his own and smoke, and you're just like, well, now it's the other way around, isn't it? Like, it used to be that all the cool people were going out and having a smoke and everyone else was just, like, stuck indoors, and now it's just like, now I'm the fucking Billy No Mates.
Even, like, the act of seduction, like, many a seduction moment for me has been out in the smoker's corner or whatever, like the guy giving you the lighter or lighting your cigarette for you or whatever, and like that kind of cheeky way of like breaking away from stuff. Like, it's still kind of continued despite like the bans, but it became less and less people like smoke now because it's such a pain in the ass, so that it's kind of like dwindling, and the only people you see in the smoker's corner now are like the weird, like,
but
weird
like people bars, like, you know, when I go to a bar, it's just indoors is just empty. Like, there's there's no one there except people getting a drink, and then everybody is just outdoors on the patio. If you go to a bar, you want to drink and smoke. Most people do.
Exactly.
So, as someone that's very into smells and stuff, like, do you have a very developed sense of taste as well? Like, do you have a really sharp sense of taste? Are those two things actually as linked as people read about, or is that just mythology? Because love food, but I'm pretty certain I have a very unsharp sense of taste because I smoke like a fucking chimney, and I, you know, it just, I very doubt that my sense of taste is very good, but like, I really enjoy food, but like, do you feel like you have a sharp nose as well as enjoying perfume?
All the French scientists that design the perfumes, they all smoke too, so you know, I don't think that's as much of an impediment as you would think, but I have exotic tastes, but I also like total trash. I like everything. I don't think my like sense of taste is uniquely sharp. I do like weird stuff, and I'm like adventurous, but also I like my, you know, favorite foods are like white trash, basic, you know, like macaroni and cheese type stuff, but I'll eat anything, you know. I do find it weird that everybody is like a beer hobbyist now, that everybody can tell like the differences and in different types of beers and wine, which like I really can't. Like, wine is just either red or white to me. Like, and beer, you know, it's like the IPA heavy ones, or it's just like Lone Star or something. But scent is a little different because it just all comes after you gain a sort of like broad historical perspective on the development of different scent trends. And you kind of have to do a little work to awaken yourself to that, because it's not something you encounter in the wild anymore. Like, people are not wearing these weird old perfumes by and large.
Yeah. Yeah. Two more questions before we round out. The one that I want to ask you is a selfish question, actually. So I'm trying to leave behind all of my girlish Miss Dior days, and I'm 27 now, so I want like a more mature scent, but something that won't frighten this one away. Something that says femme fatale. That's kind of what I'm looking for. Like, you know, that's something that's got a bit of an edge to it. Like something that sort of punishes the male gaze but also invites it. That's the kind of thing that I'm looking for.
Okay, I would go with Robert Piquet Fracas, which is a tuberose scent from the 40s, but it's like so influential and so imitated and such a classic that I just bought a new bottle of it. It doesn't smell old to me. It's just a stunning, weird, strong tuberose kind of like femme fatale scent. Like Madonna famously wears it, Courtney Love. It has like a mystique to it. If you like a more floral type, like in the gardenia area, basically just smell it. I don't know anyone who could not like it because it's just stunning stuff. And it's awesome. Cool. It has a cool history to it.
Awesome. Perfect. Okay. I'm definitely going to pursue that one because I've got the money saved. Yeah. We have it recorded, so I'm going to listen back to it and like get it. But I've got the money saved and I'm looking for a nice like perfume to get. So I'll let you know how Jake responds to it as well. Also, before we round out, the last question that we ask every guest is, what is your astrology sign?
Cancer.
Of course. And you're into perfume. Makes perfect sense.
I'm into the home, into, you know, I have a very like maternal kind of, people hate male cancers, but we feel all of the emotions for every other sign. So
I love cancers. Some of my best friends have been cancers, and cancer is also ruled by Venus. And Venus is obviously like the feminine, like, you know, about opulence and beauty. So of course, you know, perfume is there. So that makes a lot of sense.
True. Whenever I read like descriptions of cancers, I don't know so much about the other signs, but whenever I read cancer stuff, whether it's positive or negative, there's the pang of recognition.
I'm just a typical like whammon. I like own crystals and believe in astrology. So yeah, I know it's a trope. But yeah, thank you guys for listening in the audience. Moral of the story, dudes do not rock. White boy summer is lit and neither do women. Women don't rock either.
Thanks so much for having me. That was great fun.
I really liked it. And I like you too. If you're ever in London, please let's go shopping.
Please come on my show sometime. I'd love to have you.
Yes. Yeah. Anytime. Right. Seriously, hit me up. But thank you so much for coming, and thank you guys in the audience for listening. And we hope you enjoyed the show. Goodbye.